You guys all missing, are you missing daylight savings time tonight? It looks different on Wednesday night, this first Wednesday night, than it did on the first Sunday morning, back to the other way, doesn't it? Hope the week's going well for you, and I recommend a trip over here in the daylight just to see the burning bushes and stuff out here. They really have been extra pretty the last few days, and they may get blown off tonight, I'm not sure, but pretty time of the year, and the street down that way has been really pretty also. Have your Bible open to Ecclesiastes chapter 8, if you would. I wanted to ask everybody, how many of you have spent any time this week so far, either just in passing for a few moments, or maybe on purpose when you've watched the news or something like that? How many of you have spent any time kind of trying to make sense of what goes on in the world these days? Anybody? You won't admit to it? Or have you given up on it? Or do you think it's a lost exercise or lost cause? Okay. Most of us do, at least in an impression we see with things that are going on, or maybe for some other reason. Most of us do take time to try to make sense out of what goes on in the world. Linda, if you'll go ahead and move us to that point there. Next, okay. So think about my question. And if you haven't, then suppose that you do. I think everybody subconsciously, if nothing else, does. Even those of us who make a point of not watching the news do so because we kind of know what we would see and we don't want to see it. Why would anyone try to make sense out of what goes on in the world? Obviously, you haven't admitted that you do, so you probably wouldn't know the reason for that. I think that we do because we realize our lives can't matter unless everyone else's in the world does too. And I think in that way, unless we're willing to surrender to the idea that history itself is meaningless, then we try to make some kind of sense out of what takes place within history. And we try in that way to find our place in the story of what's going on. I think that's the human nature, and I think you can tell by the stories of Israel in the Old Testament that God's people have always engaged in that exercise in one way or another. So if you do consider what goes on in the world around, try to make sense of it, then what's your conclusion? David already says his is it's a lost cause. So if you think about it, this fellow Ecclesiastes has taken the first six chapters to tell us about his own personal search for something that lasts and something that has meaning in his own life. And so, personally speaking, what's been his conclusion about it? About his own place in the story? Nothing new under the sun. It's all striving after the wind. Remember, it's all hevel, it's all meaningless, it's all futile, it's all vanity and striving after the wind. So now at the end of chapter 6, our writer ends up by expressing what he has found, but then he says, "For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell what will be after him under the sun?" And then it's like the story changes, just the book changes just a little. So now, having already concluded this about his own personal search, he starts then trying to make sense out of what goes on in the broader world. He starts drawing some conclusions about what is good in the world around, and in the workings of people in the world. And he remember last week we found out he's not willing to say that simply because he hasn't found all the answers in his personal life, that therefore life doesn't matter. He still believes that wisdom matters and that some things are better than other things, like we found out last week. And he starts trying to then gradually, if you'll notice, a little more, recognize that there has to be a place for God in this story. And that's what happens in our chapter tonight. Now, one thing about this, we ended chapter 6, who knows what is good. Then we end chapter 7 at verse 29. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright and that they sought out many schemes. And then he starts chapter 8 by talking about the king who has the power. I want you to think about this for a second. If you've already decided that God made man upright and man sought out many schemes, and then you find out there's a man in charge, a man who has the power, how do you think that's going to work? Not a real hope. Notice the connection between the end of chapter 7 and the beginning of chapter 8, and think of it that way. And that's kind of where we're headed here. Now we turn to Ecclesiastes' observations about what takes place on the earth. And he'll use this phrase twice in this chapter, either what he observes that is of all that's done under the sun. That's in verse 9, or then what he has seen about the business that's done on earth. That's in chapter 6, verse 16 of this chapter. That gives you an idea of what he's talking about. What's good for man, that was the end of chapter 6. And now that turns into wisdom with regard to dealing with the world around in this chapter here, is what we'll see. So what's good, and then a man's wisdom is going to be the focus of this chapter here. And what he's going to say that he has seen are these things. First, there are the powerful. The first thing it'll be the ones who have authority, or who have power over man to his hurt, as it says at the end of verse 9 here. That's the first thing. What do the powerful people do? What does man do with his power? How does it impact people? And then he's going to say, I saw the wicked buried. And he's going to talk about the impressions left by the wicked. And then he's going to describe the injustices that he sees at work in human experience. So do those three themes sound familiar to anybody? Would you notice any struggle with either of those three terms in the news today if you were to lower yourself to thinking about what actually trying to make sense out of the world? If you were to do that, would you have to deal with either of those three topics right there? Either what people do with their authority, the ones who have power, or what people think of the wicked, or then the injustices and unfairness that happens in life. Of course, we all have to deal with those things. So the question is, how does God come into play in the middle of that? You got a man trying to make sense out of the world and finding the powerful who do what they want, the wicked who do what they get by with, and the injustices that are not fair. And then you have to think of the work of God in the middle of all of that. So is it a bigger challenge to believe, or is it a bigger challenge to look at that while you believe? Does believing make it harder or not? Where is God in all this? And it's interesting, God is going to come up, God's going to be named five times, or mentioned five times in this chapter. Some of the chapters hadn't been mentioned at all. And now in the middle of the stuff that's going wrong in the world, God becomes, even the fear of God becomes a discussion point for the second time in this book. So that's kind of what happens now. Let's kind of watch for that as we go along. And I want to try to ask for your responses to some of this, so please think along with us. We start out with a statement that in verse 1 of chapter 8 that the writer will kind of come back to at the end of this chapter, I think. But to me, the point that he starts with is that wisdom can't explain everything about how things work in the world, but wisdom can help you to put your best face forward in dealing with the world. Notice that I said your best face forward and not your best foot forward, the way we said it. We usually say it. But look at his statement. Who is like the wise? And you answered, expects a negative answer. Your answer is nobody. Nobody's like the wise. Who knows the interpretation of a thing? Nobody. That's his point. But then he says, a man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. The idea being that wisdom can at least give a person a better outlook with regard to the puzzling things that go on in the world that you can't explain otherwise. And where he's about to turn us now is dealing with the king or the ones who have power. And maybe this thought has a special application in that way. At least a respectful or positive outlook puts a person in a place to do the best he can in the world in which we all have to live. I think that's the gist of what happens here. And then in verses 2, really 2 through 9, the theme that's touched on again and again is the word power, translated in the New American Standard Version, authority. It's the same idea. So this will be what he's dealing with. How do you deal with the powers that are... I'm reading from the ESV here with this tonight. So let's start with this. I think this is the whole section is wise dealing with the king or the one who is in power. And let's just read it in parts here. Verses 2 through 4 to start with, where he's giving what he has observed is the wise thing to do in these situations. I say, keep the king's command, or this is my counsel, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him, or it might be translated because of your oath to God. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. Or some of the translations will put it, don't take your stand for evil or for a bad cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is powerful or authoritative or supreme. And who may say, what are you doing to the king? Now, what would be the main point that is made in that little section, which is also taught in other places in the Bible? There's one main idea. taught in Romans 13. It's taught in 1 Peter 2. All right. Because the authority comes from God. So that would make sense of this idea of because of God's oath to him or because of your oath to God. So the general idea here is not evaluating the proper judgments that the king makes. It's not endorsing his policies or his opinions or his ideas. It simply is concerned with how do you go about living in the world like it is. And this guy's advice is act on the king's command, because his word is powerful and it's not open for debate. Now, you're thinking about the situation in which this fellow lives. This is not teaching everything that there is to be taught about dealing with authority. It's talking about the wisest way to go about living with it. It's not saying don't try to make things better or that there's never a time for conscience sake to resist it or anything. It's simply saying the general guidance is authority is better than anarchy, and the general approach would be to be respectful in his presence. Don't make your stand for an evil cause, because the king's going to do as he pleases. His word will be powerful, and he's not going to submit himself to your questioning about it, which is all a thought-provoking thing. But that's where he starts. The second part of it is aim for the proper time and the just way. And again, wisdom would do this. He says, this is 5 and 6. Whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, know no harm, generally speaking. And the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. So notice that he has asked, verse 1, who knows the interpretation of a thing? His answer now is a wise heart. Who deals properly with authority will discover the right time and the way for what needs to be done. For there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavy on him. The point being that it's the right time and the right way won't mean that it's an easy time or way, and won't mean it's always like what we would want it to be, but this is survival taking place. This is wisdom surviving in that way. And then the last part of it, verse 7, for he does not know what is to be, for who can tell how it will be? And the point of that is, while you are wishing that king was gone, and you're thinking, surely just a different one would make it all better. The problem is, that's right, you don't know that. And what you do know is that the next one will be like the present one, in the sense that chapter 7 and verse 29 will be true of both. Look back at 7:29 and remember what it said. So there is the perpetual idea that another man would be different, and the problem is he's still a man and has the same kind of problem. So that's the first thing about dealing with power, is you conduct yourself respectfully and honorably and with the right time and the right way as much as you can. The second part of this now, chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, is what if you have power? What about the ways where you're the one who has power that you can exercise that might have an impact on people. And he says two things about this. First off, bear in mind that your power is limited. This is verse 8 to me. No man has power to retain the Spirit. And I just will say that to you that the word, this could be more of an illustration in the sense that the word Spirit could be translated wind. The New Rice Standard Version does translate it that way. Or breath. It could be an illustration that way. No man has the power over the wind or breath or power to retain the Spirit or power over the day of death. In fact, there's no day that illustrates the limits of our power more than that day does. There's no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. That's more in the sense of a proverb. When there's war, you don't get excused from your duty, and then wickedness won't deliver those who are given to it. So there are three ways that your power is limited. You can't control the realm of the Spirit or the day of your death. You can't control war, what people will do, and you can't control what wickedness does. Your power is limited. And agree or not? Have you found anybody that had power over those three things? And then the second part of it, your power is limited, but your power can hurt. Your use of what you do with the power that you have, however limited it is, can have a huge impact on someone's life. He says, all this I observed while applying my heart to all that's done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. Because we are like chapter 7, verse 29 says, what we do with our power can hurt. Who can it hurt? Can hurt other people. Can hurt ourselves. And have you ever done anything with any of your power that hurt you? For example, the power to make a choice. Yes. Or the power to speak. Power like that. So in general, I would say that what he has observed about how the world works is you have to get along with those who have power, and you have to realize that your use of your own power is the thing that impacts life more. You see what he said? You assume that what the king does with his power, or the ruler, is what impacts life. But the power that we have is the one which tends to hurt or not. That's his observation. And you might wrestle with whether you agree with him or not, but that seems to be where he's headed. Now, that's the first major section here. Now the next section that he has to deal with when he thinks about how you make sense of the world is the value judgments that human beings have, the things that we think about what's important, what our judgments are about things, and how they end up getting reversed so often. So notice the human judgments that he has to figure out how to navigate. Verse 10, then I saw the wicked buried. What lesson would there be just in that one statement? Not even finishing the rest of it. All right, the wicked, even if they're powerful, end up being buried as well. But where he goes with this is what he regards as the the mistaken value judgments that are made in this process. He says, they used to go in and out of the holy place. Now, these are the wicked now. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised. There's a translation issue that some of the manuscript evidence suggests that they were forgotten, but this translation is and were praised in the city where they had done such things. Now, what problem is he identifying there? What bothers him about that? These are the wicked. While they were alive, they went in and out of the holy place in their wickedness. Then they died, and they're buried. And what happens? They're praised. They're praised in the city which has, where they've done their wickedness. So what's his problem with that? He says this is also vanity. What's he mean by that? That would suggest that there hasn't been moral propriety in this process, that justice hasn't been done. It's not right for wickedness to be celebrated in the place where it's been done and for holiness to be dragged through the mud in that way. That's the problem he sees. That's the challenge to faith. That would make him think, doesn't really matter how you live. It just matters whether you had the power to get away with it and whether you were celebrated by people or not. And of course, then that would challenge the whole question of justice and righteousness. So how do we manage that? What do we do? How do you make sense of that? Well, look at what he says, verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. What does this verse have to do with the one just before it? What point is he making? Pardon? All right, the next generation, true, but why is it that the wicked can engage in wickedness and die and be buried and be praised in the city where he did his wickedness? It was because judgment did not occur immediately, and it looked like he got away with it, and it looked like that how he lived had been endorsed. The point that the writer is making here, just an observation that I think you could share, is the idea that because the wrong thing is not found out and is not held accountable right then, immediately, then people end up thinking that God won't do anything about it and it won't make any difference, and therefore they proceed on in doing evil like the wicked fellow in the previous verse did. Was that only a problem in the days of Ecclesiastes, or have you ever struggled with that point in our time? Do you ever wonder about this? Of course. If you think about it, you do, of course. We used to... We'd have the gospel meetings and my earliest acquaintance with the church, and a lot of the lessons would end with the idea you could die before we meet again, and there'll be a judgment, and you're going to end up in hell. And then the next summer, we'd have the meeting and the same thing, the same message. And I'll be honest, I remember thinking, I heard this last time and nothing has happened. Am I the only one who's ever thought that way? I bet I'm not. That's kind of what he's dealing with here with this. So what does he do about it? And this is where the wisdom, I think, comes through. And this is where Ecclesiastes makes its room for the fear of God for the second time. The first time was in chapter 7 and verse 18. And now it's more explicit. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before Him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. All right. It'll be well with those who fear God. It will not be well with the wicked. And here's my question. How does he know that? Does he know it by experience? Look back at verse 10 again. The wicked man lived in the city, and he went in and out, and he died, and he got a beautiful burial, and he was praised in the city where he did it. Sentence is not executed speedily against wickedness. So how does he know that it'll be well with those who fear God because they fear before Him? I'd like your answer to this one. Somebody has to say something besides me. How does he know that? Has faith. That he serves a just God. All right, any other answers that you have about it? Considering the context of this book, especially now. All right, there's the question of what God has always done for His children. But so much of the time in this book, He has seen oppression. He has seen a grievous ill done under the sun. Ruth? All right. So it would be meaningless unless this happened. So what I'm kind of leading up to is he just knows. I have a book in my library written by, or in my collection of stacks, written by a guy named Jay Budziczewski, who is a government and philosophy professor at the University of Texas in Austin, who was an atheist philosopher when they hired him, and he converted to Catholicism over the years. Now he has tenure. The title of his book is What You Can't Not Know. And it's a thought-provoking thing. So, like with this idea here, it would be a human being cannot not know that there is a judgment, that there's accountability, there's moral accountability for what we do. His point here is there has to be a God in this picture who is at work in this way. There has to be. And eventually, in our world, even the most determined unbeliever has to get down to this point. I'll give you an example. If you bring up Hitler, for example, doesn't everybody admit sooner or later that there has to be some sort of an accounting for that kind of wickedness? I think so. So what I would call it is conscience. I think this, if nothing else, is Romans 2, verses 14 through 16. I think we do all know that, Barney. And the question of Ecclesiastes is, how do you explain that if there's not a God behind the conscience? If there is not some way to explain the capacity of a human being to judge the good or evil of a word, deed, or action by conscience, where does that ability in us come from? And if it's not operable, then we're no more than animals. This fellow is saying we cannot be content to exist that way. There has to be this. And this is why I say that Ecclesiastes is an essential aspect of apologetics or Christian evidence. You can't prove God by science or history or any other way until you at least are willing to allow for the possibility of God. And conscience, the necessity of conscience, is one of the ways where you can see that you can allow for this possibility. We're going to run out of time, so my conscience means we have to move on here. But look, think about this. The next section now, verses 14 and 15, so what's a wise approach to life in the world as it is? The world's not perfect. It has problems. There are inequities and injustices in it. So what's the wise approach to living within it? There is vanity. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. You agree with him? Yep, I do. And I think because the sentence is not executed speedily from verse 11 makes this all the more confusing. Sometimes the unfairness of what goes on is so obvious in that way. Righteous people get treated like they're wicked. Wicked people get treated like they're righteous. I said this also was vanity, and I say that too. Verse 15, and I commend what? In the presence of injustice, what does he commend? Joy. Not anger, but joy. I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. This is the third time in this book now that he's made a very similar statement to that. One in chapter 2 and then in chapter 5 again and now here. What he's calling for is not hedonism. It's not Epicurean philosophy. It is the joyful use of what one is given through his toil and to regard it thankfully as God's gift. That's what he recommends. Not asceticism, not abuse of the body, not any of that, but joy. That's instructive about how you put together the cry for justice in verses 12 and 13 with the recommendation for joy in verse 15, and there's balance to that. And then in verses 16 and 17, he kind of returns back to where he started in verse 1 with a very wise admission about this situation that human beings live in. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that's done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep. Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that's done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. So he has said that he believes God must be at work in it. And he's recommended enjoying God's gifts, but he's confessed you're not going to figure out everything about how the world works and how God uses his control in the world. And the place of judgment would be the easiest way to recognize that. I would say if you turn over to Romans 11 and read the last few verses of that chapter, it'd be very much this conclusion here. I want to finish, just got a couple minutes. I found this somewhere in working on this lesson. I thought it might be a good summary to what we've said. How do we go about coping with life's unfairness and unpredictability? And I found four principles that someone drew from Ecclesiastes 8. I thought I'd leave them with you tonight. One, accept the fact that there are some things you can't change. It doesn't sound earth-shattering, but it's pretty important. Two, take comfort in the fact that not everything bad that happens to you in your life is your fault. Would you think about that? Not every injustice in the world is your fault. Three, commit yourself to God and trust Him to take care of life's injustices in His own inscrutable time and way. And four, remember that God not only knows the injustices of life, but that He shares them with us. What's the best evidence of that? Be the cross. And it'd be Isaiah 53 would be a pretty good description of that. So I'll leave them up there for a few moments, and we'll end our class with it that way. I appreciate your helping us straighten out the world tonight here. But you really think about it. This chapter is crucial in recognizing the place that God has to have in human experience, the conscience. And if it's real, then God is present whether we knew His law or not. I want to lead us in a prayer before we go. Hope you all have a great rest of the week if you'll pray with us. Father, thank you so much for the mysteries of your will and of your ways. Please help us to have the wisdom to know the right time and the just way. And help us, Father, to be people who fear you and who know that that's the main meaning of our life. Help us to take joy in your gifts. And help us, Father, to respect your control over things that we don't. Thank you for participating in the world as it is with us. Bless these dear people's life. Bless all of our homes and all of our families for these next few days. Help us as we try to comfort Helen and Cheryl and their family. And help us as we try to serve our neighbors over these next few days. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.